Now, to better understand all these stories, and all of these are parts of a whole, these large historical trends, let me suggest we listen to workers' own words in trying to describe how they felt about the world around them, what they desired. One important body of words that tell us something about workers' own perspectives, something we lack for peasants, are collective demands, especially those that were presented during strikes or periods leading up to a strike. Many of the demands, when workers got together and found somebody to write up a list of demands that they'd present to the manager or the owner of their factory or shop, tended to be the usual sort of economic or political demands that one would have heard in 1905. We're now talking about the years after 1905 especially. Higher wages, they would call for. Shorter hours. Cleaner bathrooms. Less dangerous machinery. And they would usually throw in the political demand for civil rights. For the lack of police supervision of unions and the like. Many of these collective demands by workers were focused on what might be called moral issues. We've seen this in 1905, for example. A very common demand was for polite address, that workers should not be treated like children or animals and called ty, the informal you in Russian, but should be spoken to with respect. And in fact, workers often described ordinary economic demands, demands for greater sanitation in the bathroom, for safer machinery, for higher wages, for hot water provided for tea. They described these as demands that had to do with something more fundamental than improved conditions, but was about their right, as workers like to say, to live as human beings. Indeed, this phrase, the right to live like a human being, would be heard more and more in these demands. A deeper source of how these important growing class of workers felt about their world could be found in their diaries, in personal letters that they wrote, in essays that sometimes appeared in the trade union press or the party political press, again, coming from the most concerned and active and articulate among them. And what one notices even in private diaries and letters is also the centrality of these moral issues, these dignity issues. Consider some of the phrases one often finds in these writings. Workers have the right to live as human beings, as we saw in the collective demands as well. We are not machines. We are human beings. We are not slaves. We are not cattle. We are not camels. These sort of phrases kept being heard. And sometimes workers talked because they had listened to socialists and picked up this vocabulary, talked about the exploitation of the working class. But far more often, especially in their private remarks, workers would talk about despotism and cruelty and rudeness and insult and injury. And finally, and I need not explain the importance of this to you, we've seen it so often, though mainly out of the mouths of intellectuals up until this period, workers often justified their protests as a defense of leechness, of the human person, of the self, this Russian word that suggests both the nature of human beings as human and also the natural rights that result from this. In fact, some of the most interesting and in some ways remarkable expressions of workers' aspirations come in their own poetry. Almost all workers who became literate wrote some poetry, and many wrote a great deal of poetry. They're reading, they're thinking, they're trying to express themselves. It's not very good literature. I don't recommend it to you as high literature, but it tells us something very deep about their feelings about the world around them, and thus about the nature of that world we're trying to understand. Probably the most major theme one finds in workers' poetry in these years before 1914 is the suffering individual, the suffering self. Workers wrote constantly, for example, about the anguish of a mother, a working-class mother, watching her children starve. They wrote about their own childhoods ruined and lost by the hardships of lower-class life, whether back in the village or growing up in the city. They wrote about the sexual abuse of working women by foremen and employers, where women, as it was said, their feelings of human dignity are being trampled in the dirt. And of course, they wrote about what they endured at work, low wages and dirt and violence from foremen, maimings by machines. The solution for many of these workers, and this group would play such a key role in the events to come, was fairly clear. A society and a political system that did one thing, respected the natural human dignity in all people. As we'll see when we get into the post-revolutionary period, this is a question they continue to ask about the regime that they eventually got. In other words, again, just as in talking about the intelligentsia, we come back to this critical idea of human dignity. And on the one hand, we can see that urban life, modern urban civilization, allowed this human nature, this leechness, this self to thrive. It was a city filled with opportunities at every turn. On the other hand, it was a place filled with humiliations and indignities as well. Or on the one hand, to use a worker's own words from a poem, one can find in the city the cradle of the happy future life. And you've seen so much signs of that. On the other hand, in the words of another worker, the city is nothing but a cruel abyss that swallows up life and light. As in so much else we've seen, it's the contradictory possibilities of Russian life that is the one most consistent thing we can see in Russia on the eve of war and revolution. We'll see the same even more clearly as we look at culture, cultural life in late imperial Russia, the subject of the next lecture.